The Kathleen Show, shaking things up and grabbing life by the ovaries. Here's your host, mom, wife, writer, filmmaker, entrepreneur, and overall, regular chick, Kathleen Slattery Moscow.
Hello and welcome. We're coming at you from the very cool Rock and Roll Smart Studios in Madison, Wisconsin. And today's program is online at thekathleenshow.com. In case you want to send the link to someone you like or love, or if you want to register for the podcast, this is the show about rattling some cages and shaking things up in our lives and with our health. And today we're talking about my favorite topic, creativity and passion. It's about finding our hot spot in life and having the courage to go for it. And if you think you're not creative or passionate, hold your horses. My guest today is the world's leading thinker on creativity and innovation, the very funny and inspiring Sir Ken Robinson. But before Ken comes on the air, let's do a little inventory check. Because your clock is ticking. What do you love to do more than anything in the world? What is the one thing where you feel no sense of time or lack of energy? Where you feel, yes, this is what I'm passionate about. This is what I'm good at. This is who I really am, regardless of the money. Are you doing it? Are you getting enough of it? Are you paying attention to what rocks your kids' world, encouraging them to follow their heart? Or have you been, or are you now, too practical to go after what you love or to encourage your kids to do the same? And I realize that this might sound like a strange conversation to be having with the economy in the tank and at a time when we're supposed to be just grateful for jobs, period. But let's stay with this theme of practical for a moment, because I think that this is the biggest roadblock for most of us as individuals and parents. So is it practical to work your entire life, 40 to 60 hours a week, at a job where at best you just get by, and at worst sucks the life out of you? A job where you go through the motions, watch the clock, and pray for Friday? And is this practical or at all productive for our economy? Think about all of the lack of productivity for companies to have millions of people on the payroll who are only half engaged. Or maybe they produce a bit, but not nearly to the extent that they could or would if they were where they were meant to be. Think about how much better the economy would be if each of us were in our groove, doing the things we love, doing the things we're good at. Think about how much more productive we could be, how much more joy we would have. So I guess I just caution you as you use the word practical. Don't touch that dial, because we've only just begun on this topic of creativity and passion. Coming up is the world's best mind on this topic, Sir Ken Robinson, and he'll be sharing some incredible stories and advice that will light your fire. You're listening to The Kathleen Show, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to The Kathleen Show, and without any further ado, we're going to dive into my next guest. Sir Ken Robinson is one of the world's leading thinkers on creativity and innovation. He speaks all over the globe and works with governments, Fortune 500 companies, education systems, and nonprofits to develop human potential. He has received countless international awards, and in 2003, he received a knighthood from Queen Elizabeth II for his services to the arts. Thus the Sir Ken title. In 2005, he was named as one of Time, Fortune, and CNN's principal voices, and his famous, funny, and inspiring TED Talk of 2006 continues to be one of the most watched and shared TED Talks to date. And last but not least, he is the New York Times bestselling author of The Element, How Finding Your Passion Changes Everything. Sir Ken, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kathleen. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Well, I think I need some oxygen after reading all of that.
me too.
Okay, I want to first dive into your book, The Element. But before we do, I'd just like to say that when I was reading it, I was completely in my element, which is a testament to how much I love this topic and how strong the book was, because I lost all sense of time. I was completely absorbed and I felt higher than a kite. So kudos to you.
Oh, it's wonderful, Kathleen. Thank you. I'm really thrilled to hear that.
So, Ken, tell us about The Element. What's the book about?
It's about the nature of personal talent and ability and passion. One of the things that's always struck me is that so many people have no real sense of what they should be doing with their lives, and get no real pleasure from what they do. You know, an awful lot of people do work that they have wandered into and get through it to the weekend, but with no great sense of fulfillment from it. And yet I also meet people who absolutely love what they do, you know, who couldn't imagine doing anything else, who'd almost do it for free sometimes. You know, they are, so to speak, in their element. They've found something that they just love and that really fulfills them. And I've long been interested in what it is that makes the difference and what the difference is. So the book is about that. It's about finding not only work that something you do for a living, but finding things that really are at the center of who you really believe yourself to be.
Why did you write this book? And in the book, you talk about a little interesting story about your wife's involvement, but can you... I thought that's something I would do.
Yes, I should explain that Terry and I have been together now for 32 years. And we met actually at a course I was running in 1977. And, we've been together in every way. You know, she's my life partner. She's my work partner, my best friend. And she's also, you know, that thing about behind every great man, there's the woman. I hope it's true the other way as well, you know, because she does wonderful work in her own right. She's a great writer. But she's always been there kind of pushing me when I've been hesitating. And I told a story, I might tell it in a moment if you'd like me to, that really gave rise to the book about Gillian Lynn,
choreographer. Yeah, no, please go ahead. Uh-huh.
And, the story very briefly about Gillian was that I used to be years ago on the board of the Royal Ballet in England. I'm a great fan of ballet and all of the arts, really. And Gillian is a wonderful person who most people have not heard of, but almost everybody knows the work she does. She is a choreographer, and she was responsible for Cats and Phantom of the Opera. So, you know, her work has been seen all over the world. She's absolutely wonderful. She's in her 70s now, and I asked her a few years ago how she got into dance, how she became a dancer. And she said, you know, it really nearly didn't happen because when she was at school, she was a very bad student. And in the elementary school, she didn't think much about this, but the teachers clearly did because she was constantly being distracted and wasn't concentrating and didn't hand her work in on time and all of that. Anyway, the school eventually thought maybe she had a learning disorder. Now, remember, this is in the 1930s, so this was a pretty stark judgment to make at that time. So they recommended to her mother that she went for an assessment. And she says she remembers being taken by her mother to see this man who presumably was a psychologist. And she said, you know, her mother dressed up in her best clothes and, you know, tied her hair back and, you know, put her best shoes on her. And she said she remembers going into this room and meeting this man. There's a rather severe room with, you know, leather books everywhere and oak-lined shelves. And he sat her down at the end of the room on a sofa, on a leather sofa, and then sat and talked to her mother for 20 minutes about all the problems Gillian seemed to be having at school and all the problems she seemed to be causing. And she said, you know, all the time that he was listening to my mother, he was staring at me. And said, of course, I was very unnerved by all this because I didn't think I had a problem, but everybody else seemed to think I did. So at the end of it, he sat next to me and held my hand. And he said, you know, Gillian, you've been really patient, but you have to be patient for a few more minutes because I need to speak to your mother privately. And she said, with that, they left her in the room. They walked out. But as they went out of the room, he leant across his desk and turned the radio on that was on his desk. And she said, apparently when they got into the corridor, he turned to her mother and said, just stand here for a moment and watch her. You know, there was a window back. He said, just stand where she can't see and see what she does. And she said, of course, the minute they're out of the room, she was on her feet, moving to the music, all around the room. And she said, apparently they watched her for a few minutes. And then this man turned to her mother and he said, you know, Mrs. Lynn, Gillian isn't sick. She's a dancer. Take her to a dance school. I said, what happened, Gillian? She said, she did. And I can't tell you how wonderful it was. I walked into this room, and it was full of people like me. People who couldn't sit still. People who had to move to think. She said she did ballet. She went on to be auditioned for the Royal Ballet School. She was accepted. She joined the Royal Ballet. She became a soloist. She traveled all over the world with the ballet, had a wonderful career. When that came to a natural end, she formed her own company. She had productions on Broadway and in London. And then she met Andrew Lloyd Webber later in her career, and together they were responsible for some of the most successful musical theatre productions in the history of the theatre. You know, they've given pleasure to millions, and she's a multi-millionaire. And my point is, you know, that somebody else, you know, might have put her on medication and told her to calm down.
Right.
This is my big issue, you see. I think that we all have, you know, natural abilities and talents and strengths, and often these are suppressed. Or, you know, we either do it ourselves or other people do it for us, often in for well-intentioned purposes. And one of the major ways, I believe, in which our natural talents have long been and are continuing to be suppressed is education. And I've worked in education my whole life. I'm a great supporter of teachers and of head teachers and of a different way of educating people. But too many people lose track of their talents because of the way they're educated. And I think it's getting worse, truthfully. So one of the reasons I wrote the book is to celebrate diversity and natural talent and the need to find meaning and purpose in our own lives.
And I love how you talk about in the book how, you know, you had this in you. You knew you wanted to do it. And your wife's like, you're going to do it. And she sat down and wrote the book proposal.
What happened was, I mean, I hope you'll meet Terry at some point. She's a force of nature, honestly. But I was speaking at a conference. I get asked, you know, and I enjoy doing it, to speak to a lot of events around these sorts of issues. And Terry was at this particular one. It was in Los Angeles. And I told the Gillian Inn story. It's about 5 years ago now. And you know, it had a big response in the room. And I said, I was just winding up the talk. I said, you know, I know a lot of these stories. I'm going to write a book about this one day. And as I came off the stage, Terry said, when are you going to write that book? I said, what do you mean? It was a rhetorical flourish. She said, no, you have to write that book. I said, I will, honestly. I promise you, I'll do it very soon. Of course, a couple of years passed, and in the end, she wrote the proposal herself, found the agent, and backed me into a corner. So I had no alternative but to actually do it.
Oh, goodness. I love that story, and I love this book. Okay, and the book, again, is The Element. Ken, and speaking of that, you touched on it a little bit at the beginning, but what do you specifically mean by The Element? What does this feel like? How do we know we're there? What should we be looking for?
Well, you know, it's an expression people commonly use, isn't it, to say that they're in their element when they're doing something, or so-and-so was in her element. And it means something significant, I think. It means, as I began to think about this more fully, it means at least two things. It means that you're doing something for which you have a natural capacity, you know, a natural feel. You know what this is. You know, for some people, it's picking up an instrument. You know, they immediately think, I get this. Other people can sit in front of a piano or pick up a flute and not know what way around to hold it. I was like that with the guitar. You know, I was saying a while ago that I was born in 1950, and I was given a guitar as a teenager round about the same time that Eric Clapton got his first guitar. Well, Kathleen, it worked out for Eric, is all I'm saying.
Goodness.
In a way, it didn't quite for me. You know, because you kind of got a feel for it. But for other people, it might be mathematics, you know, or it might be teaching, or it might be cooking. You know, that movie's out just now, Julia and Julie.
I heard it's great,
Julia Child just kind of felt this thing and got it. And, you know, for other people, it might be gardening, or it might be working with people. You know, but my point is that if you're in your element, the first condition is that you're doing something that you kind of get. And I don't mean you get all of it. You may have to work very hard to be in control of it. But you kind of get it. And I know some people for whom, you know, that's true of mathematics.
Right.
Not true for everybody. And that's my first big point about this, that often in the way that we judge people's abilities, we apply very narrow criteria. It's especially true in schools. You know, we often have kids who may be brilliantly good at something who feel they're not very smart because they're not good at the things that are particularly emphasized, like mathematics or learning languages or some aspects of the academic curriculum. I've written a lot in the book about this. I think it's very important we think differently about intelligence and ability. We waste far too much talent because we define it too narrowly. But the other thing is to say that being good at something isn't enough to be in your element. I know all kinds of people who are good at things that they don't like doing. You know?
Right.
I know somebody who's a concert pianist who didn't really like doing it. And I know people who do all kinds of things that they happen to be good at, but they don't much care for it. To be in your element, you not only have to be good at something, you have to love it. And if you love something you're good at, well, you know, the time passes in a very different way. You know, you often hear that said, you know, that, you know, if you're doing something you love, an hour can feel like 5 minutes. If you're dragging yourself to it, you know, 5 minutes can feel like an hour. And I speak from direct, immediate personal experience because I've just come back from the gymnasium.
How long did that feel for you?
It felt like a week and a half. And I was only on the machine for 10 minutes. But I know other people, in fact, some people I interviewed for the book, you know, who have to be restrained from going to the gymnasium. You know, I have to be forced into the place.
But
other things, you know, will pass in a flash. You know, like talking to you, you know, it'll suddenly feel like it was a minute.
Right.
You know, so that's the point. And I think, and the reason I think we talk about being in our element is because when we do things we love and that we have a feel for, it answers to something deep in our own spirit. You know, it's something that resonates with the very core of our being, that this is something we feel we were meant to do. And it's, to me, profoundly important for that reason, because it helps to give us a different sense of who we are when we acknowledge and honor and are prepared to search for these things that really make us feel our most natural self.
I love how you focus on the fact that it's a very unique journey for each of us, that it's a very authentic thing. And because of that, you can't look at, you know, your neighbor next to you or your older brother or whatever and do comparisons that way. You really have to tap into yourself, and then it's so authentic.
I think that's true, and this is the whole point. You know, we are all very different. And, I mean, it's a truism to say it. And you think, well, does that need to be said? Well, I think it does, because so often, you know, we compare ourselves unfavorably with other people's talents and abilities. And it happens, I think, particularly in education. You know, we see people are good at particular things, and we think that's the benchmark for all sorts of achievement. I interviewed all kinds of... I mean, I interviewed, for example, I'm from Liverpool in England, and which is the home of the Beatles, as you know.
Yes.
And I interviewed Paul McCartney for the book. His old school in Liverpool is now a school for the performing arts. He's the patron of it. He went to school. He's a bit older than me, I'm thrilled to say. No, but I was a kind of unreconstructed Beatles fan, and I helped in the early days in establishing his school for performing arts in Liverpool. And I got to know him a little bit through all of that, and I asked him if I could talk to him about the book, and he said he'd love to. So we did, and, you know, I asked him, for example, if he enjoyed music at school. You might think this would be true of, you know, one of the most successful composers and musicians of the modern age. You know, and he said he hated music at school. He didn't enjoy it at all. He said, in fact, he went through the whole of his time at school and nobody thought he had any musical talent at all, especially. Nobody noticed it or commented on it. One of the other people in the same class as he was, a year or two younger, was George Harrison, you know, the lead guitarist of the Beatles. And nobody noticed that he had any particular talent either. So I was saying to Paul McCartney, I said, have I got this right? I said, there was this one music teacher in Liverpool in the 50s who had half the Beatles in his class.
Now he would probably be using that as a claim to fame now.
Yeah, that's right. And he missed it, you know. Well, it's not only true of him, you know. I mean, you find it's true in the sciences. It's true often in math, in other fields as well, that people often don't discover their talents until circumstances come together to create opportunities for them. Or they meet somebody, you know, a mentor, somebody who has confidence in them. Often other people see talents in us that we don't see ourselves initially, or we don't value. You know, often I think people feel, well, if I can do this, anybody could do it. You know, because I remember Paul McCartney, I didn't ask him this question, but somebody I remember on a television interview asked him, you know, where he got his ideas for songs from. And he said, I wake up every day with tunes in my head. I go around with tunes in my head. They're just there all the time. He said, in fact, I'm amazed it's not true for other people. You know? Well, of course, it's not true for other people. It's not true for me. You know, but other people go around constantly trying to figure out, you know, plots for novels. Or I remember Martin Amis once saying that, you know, that for one of his novels, that he didn't write his novels, he wrote them down. you know?
Right, right.
And actually, Terry at the moment, my wife, is approaching 70,000 words of a novel that she's writing, and it's a really, really good piece of work. But, you know, she's got amazing energy, but when she sits down to write, the whole house comes to a standstill. You know, really, we live in a state of dereliction. I go around unshaven. We don't eat for days, you know. And
oh, I can so relate to this.
You know that this happens, then. I'm sure this is true when you're working. You know, we all emerge blinking into the daylight 3 days later. You know, people say, what happened? You know, so Terry was writing again. And she has no idea how quickly the time went, you know.
You're listening to The Kathleen Show, and I'll be right back with Sir Ken Robinson, the best-selling author of The Element. We'll be right back.
Don't look so surprised to see me. You never wanted much. It's so fun and nice to be here. Oh, how you do and such. I'm better now since I hit the ground. I was spinning.
Welcome back. I'm Kathleen Slattery Moscow, and I'm continuing this fun and inspiring conversation with Sir Ken Robinson, who is the world's leading expert on creativity and the author of the New York Times bestselling book, The Element. And just a reminder that you can go online right now and find and share the link to this interview with anyone anywhere in the world at thekathleenshow.com. Ken, why do you think that most of us settle for a less than brilliant life, a life that's outside of our element?
Well, I think there are all kinds of reasons. I mean, one of my arguments in the book is, you know, every life is different. You know, we all have unique biographies, and each of us is a unique moment in history. I mean, whatever people's religious beliefs may be, I think it's reasonable to say, you know, that, you know, each of us is a unique combination of our background, our families, our genetics, and of these times and these places and circumstances. So, you know, we've never been in this place before. So each of our biographies is unique. So clearly, what I'm going to say now, they're generalizations, and people have to decide whether they apply in their own case. But there are several things I talk about in The Element that prevent or inhibit people from pursuing it in their own lives. One whole group of issues is personal. You know, often it's personal fear or lack of confidence or a sense of not being entitled or a sense of doubting your own worth. You find this all the time, I think, you know, that people think, well, everybody else has got talent, I haven't got talent, I've never found anything about me, there's nothing special about me. And I really want to argue there's something special about all of us, about every one of us. You know, every human life is unique and special and important. And we're all born with immense natural talents. The fact is, some people discover them, and others don't. And I've found that often, certainly among the people I've interviewed, that they have a few things in common. One is that they often feel a sense of confidence about looking or pursuing this thing. They feel it matters, and they really want to make it part of their lives. Often they've had opportunities, but they've taken them. You know, and when I said that it's about passion and ability, the word I use in the book is aptitude. It's about two other things too. It's about attitude and opportunity. And attitude is really important. So often our own attitudes hold us back. And part of the argument of the book is to encourage people to take a chance, you know, to believe in themselves and to try things out they may not have tried before. But there are other factors. You know, some of them are social, and they're to do with family, you know, or friends. You know, it may just be people are living in a situation where the kind of things that they might want to pursue, you know, perhaps, you know, being a musician or doing something else or pursuing sport or changing career is frowned on. You know, and it may not even be in a hostile way. It can be enough, can't it, when somebody close and trusted to you raises the eyebrow in the wrong way, you know, when
right.
You say, I'm going to try something. I go, really? You?
Oh, that tone, you hit that tone.
Isn't it? Yeah. So there can be social factors. And again, it sometimes takes real courage to push through those. And then there are cultural factors, you know, which apply in different settings. You know, some communities, you know, some towns, you know, some countries have very different attitudes, you know, to what's appropriate, for example, for women to do, what kind of work they should be doing, how they should be behaving, what's appropriate for men to do in certain situations. So there are all kinds of inhibitions. And my point is not to say, well, just ignore all of that, but to recognize them and ask yourself, well, what is stopping you? Is there something you always wanted to try, but you haven't tried it yet? And is it because you yourself didn't have the confidence, even though other people were encouraging you, or was it that you really wanted to do it, but other people were stopping you? I think it's about taking stock of your own life. And by the way, often people say, but I have no idea what it is in my case. You know, I've tried everything, but I don't know what I'm good at. And you know, my advice on all of that is that is to really be reflective of your own life and to spend some time dwelling with yourself and to look inwardly. It's a two-way journey, really. One is to look inwardly and to ask yourself, when were the times that you felt, you know, most settled, most engaged, either in work or activities, the things where you really felt that you were doing something that you were naturally good at. And it's also then an outward journey to perhaps explore things you haven't tried before, to put yourself in new circumstances, to make contacts you haven't made before.
Okay, this is the Kathleen Show, and we're going to hop out for a message from our sponsors. But during the break, check out Sir Ken's book, The Element, at his website, sirkenrobinson.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the studio. This is the Kathleen Show, and today we're talking about the good stuff in life, creativity and passion. And rejoining me is Sir Ken Robinson, the world's leading authority on human potential, and his book is the bestseller, The Element. Ken, do you have a passage that you'd like to read from the book?
Well, I thought I might read a little bit from the introduction to the book.
I would love that.
You know, about how this actually came about. I mean, I've said that there was a certain amount of encouragement is probably the right word for my wife. But she's always been, you know, not just a support to me, but an inspiration. But so has my family. You know, I've always been privileged. I'm from a large family. I have five brothers and a sister. And so I dedicated the book to them. And also my two children, who, you know, to me have, again, illustrated the themes of the book by being so different. But so let me just read, if I may, from the very beginning of the book, which is the story that I came across that seemed to nail something very important about children. So it's a few years ago, I heard a wonderful story, which I'm very fond of telling. An elementary school teacher was giving a drawing class to a group of six-year-old children. At the back of the classroom sat a little girl who normally didn't pay much attention in school. In the drawing class, she did. For more than 20 minutes, the girl sat with her arms curled around a paper, totally absorbed in what she was doing. The teacher found this fascinating. Eventually, she asked the girl what she was drawing. Without looking up, the girl said, "I'm drawing a picture of God." Surprised, the teacher said, "But nobody knows what God looks like." The girl said, "They will in a minute." I love this story because it reminds us that young children are wonderfully confident in their own imaginations. Most of us lose this confidence as we grow up. Ask a class of first graders which of them thinks they're creative, and they'll all put their hands up. Ask a group of college seniors this same question, and most of them won't. I believe passionately that we're all born with tremendous natural capacities, and that we lose touch with many of them as we spend more time in the world. Ironically, one of the main reasons this happens is education. The result is that too many people never connect with their true talents, and therefore don't know what they're really capable of achieving. In that sense, they don't really know who they are. I travel a great deal and work with people all around the world. I work with education systems, with corporations, and with not-for-profit organizations. Everywhere, I meet students who are trying to figure out their futures and don't know where to start. I meet concerned parents who are trying to help them, but instead often steer them away from their true talents on the assumption that their kids have to follow conventional routes to success. I meet employers who are struggling to understand and make better use of the diverse talents of the people in their companies. Along the way, I've lost track of the numbers of people I've met who have no real sense of what their individual talents and passions are. They don't enjoy what they're doing now, but they have no idea what actually would fulfill them. On the other hand, I also meet people who've been highly successful in all kinds of fields, who are passionate about what they do, and couldn't imagine doing anything else. I believe that their stories have something important to teach all of us about the nature of human capacity and fulfillment. As I've spoken about these at events around the world, I found it's real stories like these, at least as much as statistics and the opinions of experts, that persuade people that we all need to think differently about ourselves and about what we're doing with our lives, about how we're educating our children and how we're running our organizations. This book contains a wide range of stories about the creative journeys of very different people. Many of them were interviewed specifically for this book. These people tell how they first came to recognize their unique talents and how they make a highly successful living from what they love. What strikes me is that often their journeys haven't been conventional. They've been full of twists, turns, and surprises. Often those I interviewed said that our conversations for the book revealed ideas and experiences they hadn't discussed in this way before. The moment of recognition, the evolution of their talents, the encouragement or discouragement of family, friends, and teachers, what made them forge ahead in the face of numerous obstacles. Their stories are not fairy tales, though. All of these people are leading complicated and challenging lives. Their personal journeys have not been easy or straightforward. They've all had their disasters as well as their triumphs. None of them have perfect lives, but all of them regularly experience moments that feel like perfection. Their stories are often fascinating, but this book isn't really about them. It's about you.
You know, the thing I did love about the book was just how many stories there were, and they were so inspiring. But one of the things that just did it for me was the sense of realism in the book. The story that this sometimes is a struggle. This isn't always easy, because I think people need to understand that there will be roadblocks. And when you understand that other people have faced issues too, that can be as inspiring as their successes. So I was so grateful that you chose the people you did and that you emphasized the reality of the situation. And I wondered if you could talk about that a little bit more.
Well, I think it's really important. You know, I have interviewed a number of people for the book who are well known. You know, they're known for either work in movies or in music or in business or in sport. But not all the people in the book are well known. I mean, it's not just crammed full of celebrities. You know, there are other people there that I think readers will be surprised to read about. But my point is that, including some of the well-known people, some of the celebrities like Paul McCartney and Meg Ryan and others, is that they weren't born as celebrities. You know, they have become well-known because they pursued a particular passion and because they've taken opportunities which came their way and have demonstrated a whole series of commitments to fulfilling what they believe they had in them. And that's one of the reasons we know about them. And that's one of the reasons I also wanted to include, I say, celebrities. Not because I wanted it to be a celebrity book, but to illustrate that even people who are well-known have really had to struggle and fight to get there. In fact, often it's especially true of such people. And that the journeys that everybody that I know have made have been full of twists and turns and setbacks. And some people survive them and others have to pause and regroup and change direction. My point about the element is that if you pursue a passion, if you pursue a talent and find room for it in your life begins to change. You bring other people into your lives, other opportunities come your way. Your life reconfigures, you have new experiences, and you're changed by them. You know, that life is not linear. It's not preset in a linear route. It's not like going along railway tracks. It's organic. You know, our life flows around us and changes as we respond to opportunities and become a new person in the process. I mean, I think your own life, if I can say so, is a great example of that. I mean, if you look at your own journey, you know, from your early days in university to your, you know, career in pharmaceuticals,
right,
to that shift you made, you know, into movies and writing and directing and now the work you're doing now on the radio. I mean, I'm sure you didn't think, and nobody thought when you were at school at 15, that one day, you know, if you graduated from school and worked in the drugs industry, one day you'd have a radio show and be a successful film director.
I can guarantee you nobody. nobody said that or thought it, including myself. So
exactly,
I so resonated with this book. It so grabbed me. Okay, we're going to go out to a quick break. But when we come back, I'll be right back with Sir Ken Robinson, and we got to wrap things up. But this is just so darned exciting. Kathleen Slattery Moscow, and I'm wrapping up my very fun discussion with Sir Ken Robinson about the joy that comes with from doing what you love and what you're good at. And he discusses a lot of inspiring examples, stories, and advice in his book, The Element, How Finding Your Passion Changes Everything. Ken, we are right up against the clock, but what are some specific steps that you'd recommend for any of us to get moving in the right direction?
Well, you know, we've talked a lot about children and schools. But I'm very keen to emphasize this isn't just all about children. I have a chapter in the book called It's Not Too Late. And I think it's really important this, you know, that an awful lot of people think, well, you know, my moment's past now. And I think as long as you're drawing breath, you know, and you're alive and alert, that there is still time to reassess and look at areas of your life that you want to deepen or to extend or explore more fully. I know an awful lot of people, you know, in the middle of their lives, and of course, I'm a boomer, so I think the middle of our lives has changed for a later date now, you know. So
yeah, 80 is the new, what, 20, right?
That's right. In their 90s, just in late teenage years. But even then, you know, that there are opportunities to look back. You know, life is not a one-way street in the end. So there's always time to reassess and to rethink. So it's not just about children if you have them. It's about your life, whatever age you are. And as I say, I think it's a two-way journey. One is inward, is to reflect and take time to think about your own strengths and passions and interests over the course of your life. You know, were there things when you were younger that you really wish you'd pursued? I mean, have you revisited that? Were there things you were doing at school that you'd like to have done more of that you were stopped from doing? And did you have well-intentioned family who were discouraging you from doing something you really felt you wanted to try? I mean, if you wanted to write and never did, have you revisited that? You know, if there are areas of social contact or work that you want to do, have you ever been back to try it again? So, and I don't mean just sitting making lists. I mean, often it's a good idea to do a storyboard, you know, to sit with a whole load of magazines and clip out pictures and compose images that excite you and that resonate with you and ask what it is about them that you're drawn to. Because often our subconscious tells us things that our conscious mind inhibits or stifles. So I think it's about relaxing and maybe even taking time to meditate and to think more clearly in that way about your own drives and passions. But as I say, I think there's a second part of this journey, which is to go out and try things. You know, if you've never salsaed before, go and do it. You know, if you've never been to a science museum, go and see one. If you've never taken classes outside of working time, go and do that. Make a list of things you think you should try and some things you think you would never have tried and see how you respond to them. And my final point just about this, because I know time is running out, I'm not just talking about things you do for a living.
Right.
I think that sometimes we have to do all kinds of, well, no, I mean, I live in the same world as everybody else. You know, I have children and a mortgage and, you know, we have bills to pay. I mean, I wish we didn't, but we do. It isn't always that you have to drop your life and go on the road. I think it's about balancing the things you have to do with things that you'd love to do. Now, some people make a living from things they love to do and some people don't. But finding room in your life for that is really important. And by the way, sometimes things you speculate your time on for the love of it end up having a much more powerful place in your life than you might have expected. I think that may have been true for you with your own writing.
Right.
And I think it's certainly true.
It certainly wasn't paying the bills.
No, that's right. It wasn't paying the bills, you know, but look where it's taken you now. So it's being willing to speculate and in the end, having confidence in your own uniqueness and your entitlement to do things that have power and meaning and purpose in your life.
Ken, I want to thank you so much for being with me today and for all of your amazing work and the book, The Element, and your TED Talk and every other way that you touch people. I just want to thank you.
Well, thank you, Kathleen. I really, really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
My guest was Sir Ken Robinson. His must-read book is The Element, How Finding Your Passion Changes Everything. And you can find out more about Ken at sirkenrobinson.com. We also have the link to his interview and more about Ken at our site, thekathleenshow.com. And just like me, Sir Ken is also on Twitter, so come tweet with both of us. Okay, stay right where you are because coming up, I have a pick of the week that you'll love, but also want to chuck against the wall at times. This is The Kathleen Show, and we'll be right back. Hello and welcome back. You're listening to The Kathleen Show, and my pick of the week is a classic, an oldie but a goodie, and one of those books that makes you wonder if we'll ever see the likes of such great writers again. It's The Scarlet Letter by Nathaniel Hawthorne. The back cover describes it as a story about an ardent young woman, her cowardly lover, and her vengeful husband. It will captivate you and haunt you, but at several points, I just wanted to throw the book against the wall because the character so infuriated me. But my Irish temper aside, Nathaniel Hawthorne had me hooked and racing page to page. And just a little side note on Hawthorne, he kind of cracks me up because he ran with the whole crowd of Thoreau and Emerson, but at one point he decided to go back to his hometown and get a real job. And it was actually from this job, which was in fact a very dull job at a custom house, that the idea for The Scarlet Letter was born. So you never can tell where or when inspiration will strike. Because as one reviewer said about The Scarlet Letter, quote, "the one American literary work which comes as near to perfection as is granted a man," unquote. We'll have The Scarlet Letter up on our site, thekathleenshow.com, as well as a quote about the way Hawthorne's wife responded to the book, which just cracked me up. And that's it for this hour. I'll be right back with most of you for hour two. And for everyone else, have a red hot creative week. We'll see you next time.
Well, I was thinking yesterday, I can't wait another day without you.
Hello, this is Kathleen. It's been so much fun to pull some of these beautiful interviews from our archives. In total, we've selected 50 past interviews to re-release, and we will be recording and posting new episodes as well each week. You can help us out a ton by subscribing to the podcast, and if it's on your heart, please also leave a review and share the episodes you love with everyone you know. And finally, if you are interested in the yoga and meditation aspects of my work, those are the aspects that are instrumental to who I am as a person. If you are interested in yoga and meditation, please check out my online video series, Yoga for Beginners, where I teach you the fundamentals of several key poses in yoga. You will learn step by step what to do and what not to do in each pose, and you will walk away feeling capable about your ability to do yoga. And you are always welcome to come to Madison, Wisconsin and spend some time doing yoga at my studio, which is called The Studio. We offer a full array of daily classes as well as yoga teacher training. The studio really is a breathtaking and life-changing sort of place. Come visit us anytime. Thanks, everyone.